Right now, free speech is under heavy attack in New Zealand and overseas, with governments constantly devising new ways to enforce censorship. To make sure you never miss the critical news and breaking stories you rely on, join the RCR mailing list today. Get connected now at realitycheck.radio/email.
Liam here has been on The Crunch before, and recently he's written some pretty good articles on his Substack, The Blue Review. One was about a very reluctant Chloe Swarbrook. It was satirical and quite funny. And another was his belief that a Maori parliament would do no harm. To talk about these and more, Liam joins me now. Welcome back to The Crunch, Liam, here. It's great to have you back, and I want to touch on a couple of things today of some articles you've written on your Substack, The Blue Review. The first one is our little friend Chloe Swarbrook, but welcome back anyway.
Well, thank you for welcoming me, and I'm glad to be back.
Yeah, so Chloe Swarbrook has announced last week or did another sort of hagiographic interview where she said, oh, look, she's very reluctantly taking up the job as the leader of the Green Party, and echoed her reluctance to being a politician. Now, you've written a satirical piece on this in the Blue Review. What's your views on Chloe Swarbrook and her reluctance?
Well, you know, I'm very reluctant to, you know, share my opinions, as you know, but, you know, destiny has forced me to engage in some punditry on this issue. And so with great reluctance, I'll take up the, you know, the calling of the times and let you know that I think it's a joke, you know. But funnily enough, Cam, that article I wrote for the Blue Review about the reluctant politician, I wrote that a while ago, right? I think it might have been about 6 or 7 weeks ago at least.
Yes.
Because it was the last time that they had emerged. And, you know, it got a bit of attention. It was read quite well. The numbers were all right. And so, you know, sometimes, you know, when you puncture an image like that, the result is that the media backs off it, but they've only doubled down. I couldn't believe it that once again we had this article or this podcast on Stuff where the theme of the whole thing was, you know, this is the person who never wanted to be a politician, despite the fact she spent almost the great majority of her adult life anyway, either running for office or holding office or seeking office. You know, it's you can understand about politicians wanting to, you know, project a mythical image about themselves. You would think that the journalist class, who so often hold themselves out as, you know, the people who puncture these narratives, they just go along with it. And that's the biggest joke of all.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? With all of the you know, the problems that there are in the media environment, you know, where trust is falling, you've got all the media who are losing jobs saying, but who's going to hold the powerful to account? Well, it's not them. Mm. You've got somebody here who will be a minister in a Labour-Green government, somebody who has created this fantasy that they're very reluctant about everything they do. And the media doesn't puncture that. As you say, the media doesn't skewer her and say, well, come on now, hang on a second.
The issue is how partial it is, right? I mean, for whatever reason, and the thing is, I've met Chloe Swarbrook a couple of times. I actually found her really, you know, delightful to have a conversation with. You know, I think that's true of a lot of politicians, to be honest with you. But, you know, when it comes to people like Christopher Luxon, I guess, you know, people will quite rightly and happily try to puncture the narrative he tries to put out about himself. You know, and, you know, if he talks about being a this experienced businessman who ran an airline, that quickly becomes a meme, you know, against him, and rightly so. And the same went for, you know, Chippy from the Hut, you know, this.
And John Key, of course, being the money trader, they dug into that. The Labour Party actually spent vast sums of money trying to get John Key on the so-called H fee. Mm. But
for whatever reason, that narrative is just accepted, you know, and not only accepted but amplified, and it is I wouldn't say it's frustrating, it's funny. I think it's funny because I think most people see through it. I mean, most people would see someone who's, you know, in their 20s or has been a politician throughout their 20s, claiming to be a reluctant politician, most people just laugh at that. And it's only the people who are sort of propagating that narrative in a self unaware way that are doing the real disservice to themselves.
Mm. I mean, when she ran for the Auckland mayoralty, she was 22. She's now 30.
And she did a great job, right? You know, she came third. You know, good on her, I suppose. You know, personally, you know, I think that career politicians we criticise all the time. Sometimes career politicians turn out to be good politicians. Winston Churchill was a career politician, right? Not that I'm comparing them. Not for
was
a
he
minute.
Reluctant? He was pretty reluctant too.
Yeah, well, you know, he would. I suppose he might say so. But like Swarbrick, you know, he spent his whole time in and around politics, his whole adult life. So it's you know, just own who you are. I would say own who you are. Own that you're an ambitious person who wants to be at the top of things. Wants to tell people what to do with their lives. And, you know, I might not agree with that, but at least you could respect it a bit more.
I mean, you know, I've been involved in politics for almost all of my life, in and around politicians. And I could be sort of conservative and say for 40 years, and I'm 55, but it's probably longer than that. And I have a very cynical view of politicians. In my view, the majority of them are sociopaths. They certainly have narcissistic personality disorder, and they don't enter this thing called politics reluctantly ever.
I think you're right. I mean, okay, I'm not sure if you're right on a diagnosis, because I hope to say I'm just a humble jobbing provincial lawyer. I can't medically diagnose people. But I don't think something that that I've always felt is that anyone who gets into politics, anyone who puts their hand up for elected office, they see themselves as being in the big chair, right?
You're right. They all think they're the next prime minister.
I know. And I remember when David Cunliffe was asked, you know, before he became the leader, would you want to be prime minister? Be a horrible job. Can you imagine? Oh, man, I could never see myself having to go through all that. You know, that's just so fake. It's they all do. Even the lowliest list MP, even the lowliest backbench MP, they dream that one day circumstances might just deliver them to the big seat. They can all see themselves as prime minister. I remember Peter Dunne when he was the after the 2002 election, when United Future had the big surge to 6%.
Because of a worm.
And he did an interview where he said, I can see a path, you know, the National Party is in decline. I can see a path for New Zealand United Future to come through the middle, and I could end up being the prime minister, you know. And it just went to show that, yes, they all have those delusions of power and grandeur, every single one of them. And I'm friends with them. That's why some of them are my mates, and that's okay. But, you know, there's something wrong with you that makes you want to run for office, and it's none of them are low on ambition.
No, I mean, you know, it rather begs the question why no one in the media does a Nelson Muntz when they make these claims, you know, and just sit there and go, ha, 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 because that's how credible their claims are.
Yeah. I mean, just own it, I say. I mean, you and I, you know, I mean, we're hardly perfect. And, you know, we wouldn't do commentary, and we wouldn't get involved in political controversies if we ourselves weren't, you know, didn't sort of have a kind of an ambitious streak or a desire to be in amongst it and to, you know, make a difference. And, you know, there's a certain vanity to that, right? I just think you should own it. You should just accept that that's part of who you are, and not try to pretend to be something you're not.
I mean, are we going to see Chloe Swarbrick continue to make this claim that she's a reluctant politician, that she reluctantly is leading the Green Party? She'll reluctant. I can just imagine after the next election, God forbid, that the Greens are in a position to negotiate with Labour. And I could just imagine her on election night. Well, reluctantly, I guess we're going to have to talk to the Labour Party.
Yeah. You know? There's no doubt that narrative will continue because it's not getting any pushback, right? Like, why would you, as a politician, confront a more unappealing reality if the media was going to not only allow you to push a different narrative, but actually support it and propagate it? So, of course, until the day comes that people start laughing about it in the media, it'll continue. And that's the thing, Cam, is that the one thing that destroys any type of pretension is being laughed at. And
howls of derisive laughter, as they said in Monty Python, howls of derisive laughter.
It's the great leveler.
Yeah. But I can still see it. I can picture it now. You know, they sign a coalition agreement. Chloe Sprawbrook stands up and says, well, you know, the voters have chosen and reluctantly we've been had our hand forced and we're going to be forming a government with the Labour Party. And reluctantly I'll be Deputy Prime Minister. just go on and on.
Or reluctantly I'll be the Minister of Statistics because that's what I really got into politics to do, to get a limousine for having a a low priority, low influence ministerial sinecure. That's what always frustrates me about little parties is, you know, they campaign on these big ideas and then they become Minister of Consumer Affairs or something.
Is it just little parties that that the media fail to account, or is it just certain kinds of parties? Because we see the Green Party, and I mean, they've still got this ongoing investigation into Darlene Tarner. It's been 90 odd days on a fairly straightforward investigation. There's no real credible media questioning of that. You've got Te Pāti Māori, who make appallingly racist comments about everybody other than, you know, Māori. And then there's also their attacks on the wrong kind of Māori is the way they look on it. But the media says nothing about that, yet Shane Jones says something and all of a sudden it's a major scandal and New Zealand First are demons personified. You know, Christopher Luxon makes a mistake on something, the media attack on that. You just don't see the same sort of scrutiny of particularly the Green Party, who always sort of cower behind the shield of sanctimony and the cloak of hypocrisy. And the Maori Party are exactly in the same position. It's like they're the media darlings and we'll just ignore all of their foibles, false steps, and outright disastrous type policies and statements.
But what about the Uffinda report? That's what everyone would say in response to that. You know, like it's just
Well, at least we've had the Uffendale report, you know.
It was done inside like in 2 months it was done.
He was a kid.
The thing is, the point I made the other day was that the Challenger shuttle inquiry, when the Challenger space shuttle blew up, that was done inside, I think, 100 days or 105 days. And the Darlene Tarner, it was to work out why a space shuttle exploded, killing all those people.
Yeah.
The Darlene Tarner report is going to blow past that time frame to find out whether or not someone paid an employee or not. But look, the thing is, I think that the points you make are essentially accurate. I think that the Green Party did used to be treated as a party with a lot more kid. There was much more of a kid glove approach than there is now. I think that it's come in a little bit. And I remember when Matilia Ture confessed to, that she had wrongfully claimed the benefit, right, or something like that. There was some, I can't quite remember what it was, but it was a benefit incorrectly, fraudulently claiming a benefit.
It was benefit fraud. Let's just state it what it was.
And so there was a media interview about. So at first, the media sort of rallied around her, and it was going to be this big moment, and the public really hated it. The public hates anything like that, and that was a disconnect between the media and the public. And so eventually the narrative turned on it a little bit, and I think it might have been Audrey Young wrote a column about how, maybe it might not have been Audrey Young, so don't I'm not going to back up on that, but someone wrote a column about how the Green Party were just sort of really, the staffers were blindsided by the fact that the media had started to ask them hard questions or weren't being as friendly. And they had sort of had this entitlement mentality that they would always be sort of treated with a sort of a friendly way. And so I think, you know, that the gloves came off a little bit for that. And then we had the Green School fiasco. Remember that all that money that went to this for rich kids and a fancy private school? It was called the Green School.
Yep.
And so, while I think Schwarbrick has recaptured a bit of that that sort of old, unadulterated, just glorious cover, I think that the Greens, while they get off they get off easy still. They don't get quite as easy as TPM. And Te Pāti Māori, I've just been astonished over the last, you know, couple of years as that party's evolved into quite an extremist party that says extremist things that would get any other political, any other MP who said those things, you know, accusing the government of the day of genocide and things like that, they would be hounded out of politics.
Well, and you can remember when David Seymour made a quip about, you know, Guido Fawkes being the only person who ever entered Parliament with honourable intentions.
Yeah.
And talked about, you know, him going into some government departments. The media were screaming, you know, David Seymour wants to blow up this ministry.
And yet
we've got multiple Maori Party MPs that are saying out loud that it's time for a revolution. Now, no revolution happens anywhere in the world without bloodshed.
Yeah, well, I think personally you can – revolution, I think you can say, is a metaphor. What's not a metaphor is saying that the government is exterminating Māori. And do you remember when Tariana Turia, do you remember when she used compared the Pariaka to the Holocaust or something? Yeah. And it was sort of an early Clark government. And there was this huge hullabaloo about it, and Clark made Turia apologise, you know, and it wasn't a real apology. But there was this big pushback on it because it was an extremely insulting and wrong thing to say. And yet here we have multiple instances of a political party saying that about the existing government. And you know, when they're confronted on it, they double down. And whenever it's reported in the media, there's always been this contextualizing of it, right? You know, like it's never reported straight. It's always reported with a kind of a justification to it. And, you know, but it also comes down to things like, you know, the Māori Party's economic policy, right? They released the economic manifesto. It was insane. Like it had this insane wealth tax that would just impoverish the country. It was almost like a Robert Mugabe type economic policy.
No questioning of it.
Or when it was questioned, there'd be one question and they'd be sort of laughed off, and then there was never a follow-up question, right? And that's what's always been a little bit frustrating to me about TPM is that sometimes the media will ask questions, but they'll never ask the hard follow-up questions. They'll always let MPs from that party off the hook. And it's just, you know, and I've always wondered what it was. You know, I think part of it's fear, right? Part of it's fear of being accused of being racist. You know, not wanting to incite a backlash or a counterattack. But now that, you know, the story can't be ignored, and, you know, we actually had some pretty good journalism from the likes of Andrea Vance on it, what we're seeing is that all of a sudden the Māori Party is struggling because for so long they've been pushing on an open door, right? For so long, bad behaviour has been either ignored or rewarded. And now that the story, you know, that's sort of bad behavior is habit forming, right? And now that they're in the habit of it and it can't be ignored anymore, I think finally we're going to start to see some pushback. And, you know, it's a start, but hopefully it goes further and we actually start to have a bit more confrontation against TPM in terms of the zany, off the wall, but frankly dangerous things that they say.
I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I've raised the issue of them using imagery of, I mean, I know they're flintlock pistols, but it's the imagery of guns nonetheless.
Yeah.
And burning in the background and videos with ominous music and war drums beating and that sort of thing, along with a message that says revolution, that we can do what we want. We can remove any government that we don't like.
Yeah,
that sort of rhetoric. There's some people who on my own website say, "Oh, we should just ignore them. You know, they're just rowdies." Well, that's what they said about a little Austrian fellow who wasn't a very good painter and had a silly moustache. "Oh, we'll just ignore them." But exactly the same situation kind of exists. You had Adolf Hitler, who had this little gang of thugs who bullied, beat, broke, smashed their way into power.
Yeah.
And we've got Te Pāti Māori with this rhetoric that's being also echoed by, ironically, the stormtroopers of the mongrel mob who talk about that sort of thing and are closely aligned with many of the gangs in New Zealand who are, you could argue, echo the thuggery and the behaviour that existed back in the 1930s in Germany.
Well, they even use the same swastika, all right?
Well, they do. There we go. And, but, and they even used the Zig Hail chant and bark like dogs.
Just like John Tamahiri. Look, the thing is, I guess, yes, I think there is always a danger of saying, right, well, we didn't. It's like that movie Conan the Barbarian. Remember that movie?
Yeah.
Just a few years ago, they were just another snake cult, you know, and it's sort of, it's true, you know, like small problems can become big problems just, you know, if you don't squash them. I guess that I'm probably a little bit less fearful of it to an extent, because I think that, you know, in Germany in the after the First World War, you had, you know, a country that didn't have a democratic tradition, didn't have a liberal tradition, and, you know, the country had just been defeated in a massive war, and they were turning to, you know, someone who was promising to, you know, make the country rise from the ashes, and of course also was a you know, appealing from a majority position against minorities.
Mm.
Not that I'm saying it makes it any better. I'm just saying that it's a bit more, you know, you have a bit more to fear in that scenario than you do when TPM has quite an inbuilt limited audience. And the point I would just try to make, and this is the point I tried to make about my Māori Parliament thing that just got me got me so rinsed by the right, was that Te Pāti Māori doesn't win a lot of votes. You know, they ran about 100,000 votes in the last election. The rhetoric has a lot of purchase with the universities, the public sector maybe, and the media. Those are all institutions, sort of liberal institutions that are dominated by liberals that are in decline and who are less and less trusted by the majority population. And I think that the conflation of TPM with Māoridom is just wrong. I mean, this cabinet is 40% people of Māori descent, right? And so,
they're not the right kind of Māori, though. That's what they say. You know, basically, that when you read between the lines and what Te Pāti Māori says, is they ignore that, and they basically are saying they're the wrong kind of Māori. We saw that the shameless attack on Karen Shaw, wrong kind of Māori. David Seymour, he's a white Māori. This sort of behaviour, outright racism, actually.
Imagine saying that about Shane Jones, eh? Imagine saying that Shane Jones, with his life experience, everything he's done, saying that he's somehow not a real Māori person, you know? It's just incredible. But, you know, you know, like everyone in this, you know, in this country, you know, we interact with Māori every day, you know, as friends and family and
we interact with Kiwis every day.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. They're just ordinary people, you know. They're no different than Pākehā, or, you know, just get along. And so I think it's really a fictitious thing for the media to make out like in some way Te Pāti Māori is the voice of Māori in this country. It just isn't. It's a small minority. Now I'm not trying to downplay the fact that it only takes a small number of radicals to make big problems. That's absolutely true. And if things progress to the point where we start to have real attacks on sort of civil society or an ordered society, then it doesn't take a whole lot of people to create a whole lot of problems. And the government of the day has to be strong and forthright and to apply standards equally to stop that from happening.
Mm. I mean, it is a small group, and you could ignore them, except, you know, I received via email the other day, I don't know how I received it. Somehow it's been sent to me for some reason. But this is the kind of wording that is in there. I'll just quote some of it for you. Movements are strengthening in Aotearoa, working to further Tino Rangatiratanga decolonisation, constitutional transformation and Te Tiriti justice. That sounds okay at that stage. And it says here, at the same time, our present coalition government and its outright attack on a Te Tiriti-based Aotearoa are emboldening racist and reactionaries. Challenging this backlash and anti-Maori racism is part of the ecosystem in creating a Te Tiriti-based future, and all tangata Te Tiriti have a responsibility and role to play. Then they go on and say, some of you may recall that Tauiwi Tautoko began as Action Station Initiative and that we continue to support this kaupo. Tauiwi Tautoko is now its own charitable. Now, they use the word Tauiwi, right, which they say that means non-Maori. It actually means a foreigner even worse, a settler. And this, and it goes on and on. It says, talking about they want to transform by challenging anti-Maori racism from within Tauiwi communities. So they're saying within foreign communities. So they're talking about communities that exist within New Zealand, of New Zealanders, of Kiwis, of voters, and calling them foreigners.
Who is this from? Who did this come from?
Well, I haven't. It's that bit's been trimmed off.
Okay.
But oh no, here we go. It's and for the Action Station and Tauiwi Tautoko team. So Action Station's a hard left bunch of activists that are pushing this narrative.
Yeah. So Action Stations are sort of like the Atlas Network, except for the media never covers it like that. You know,
when someone says Atlas Network, I just imagine myself as Homer Simpson in the Simpsons movie where he backs into the hedge out of the way. You know, it's like, okay, you went there. You went Atlas Network. Mm. Okay. Mm.
So people can say what they want, right? I mean, like.
Oh, sure.
My family's came to this country in 1842. All right. It's the only country. I don't have citizenship of anywhere else. You know, our family's lived in the same district since the 1870s. I'm not a foreigner to this country. This is the only country I have. It's my home. And, you know, people can say what they want. I don't care. You know, this is my home. And at the same time, I guess it comes down to that freedom of speech thing. And we just have to trust, I suppose, that for most people, that kind of thinking is a real turnoff. It's alienating. It doesn't have a lot of support. And the trick is to make sure that it doesn't worm its way into official policy through the non-democratic means, you know, through the public sector, through universities.
By osmosis,
yeah.
Yeah.
Because you know, that's just, and to accuse me of being a settler or you being a settler, we grew up here, you know, that most people would see that for what it is, which is just insulting and ridiculous.
Oh, I get it on X all the time. Someone says, "Oh, you're a racist," and I always reply, "No, I'm a Fijian."
Yeah. Now, you're not a real Fijian though, Cameron, because you know, like, you're not left wing, right? So that means you can't possibly be a person of colour.
Well, you know, I was born in Fiji. I've got a Fijian birth certificate. I'm Fijian, right? I had to take New Zealand citizenship by descent, right? Not as of right, by descent. I remember getting my first passport and I had to get it by descent.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you could say I'm Tauiwi.
Yeah, like the great African-American Elon Musk.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But, yeah, that's the thing. You wrote that article on the Blue Review, but you were basically saying Maori want to Maori Parliament, so what?
Yeah, I mean, look, despite everything I've just said, you know, it's this country, we did have a treaty, right? And so there was a crown still exists. It's the same crown. Iwi still exists. It's the same Iwi. It's not the same as every other ethnicity. There is a difference, and you know, it's hard to give effect to that because, you know, it's when the treaty was signed, you know, Iwi, you know, they genuinely had control of their own territory, and that's gone away. There's no territorial basis for any kind of autonomy anymore. But if people want to get together and say, look, you know, we've got a common heritage, we've got a common ancestry, we've got a common culture, we want to promote that, we want to try and have as much self-determination as we can, that's just freedom of expression and assembly to me. We cross the line if you advocate for, you definitely cross the line if you advocate for overthrowing the government or disobeying the government's laws. Mm. And maybe that will come, and that would be something to crack down on severely. But for something I always think about, Cameron, you might not, you might think this is weird, is, you know, I come from a culture that's a, you know, Irish Catholic culture. It was a with 1,000 years of that being handed down in our family down to me. I want to be able to raise my kids in our family religion. I want them to have our family values, and I want them to pass it on to their own children.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are lots of people in the New Zealand state or people involved in politics who hate those values and think that those values are outdated and wrong and medieval.
And should be secondary to Maori culture and values, whatever those are.
But even just secular culture, values and culture, right? Mm. And, you know, because I want the freedom to be able to hand on that culture, right, and to be able to hand that on to my own children and to raise my children the way I want, I kind of just have a sympathy against sort of the homogenization of everything and everything having to be run like Wellington liberals want. And so I just have I have an innate sympathy for people who want to preserve their own patrimony. And I think, you know, as long as it doesn't cross the line into actually advocating sedition or rebellion, and, you know, maybe the case can be made that that's already happened, but personally just haven't quite seen it yet. Until that happens, it just reminds me of some of the Māori parliaments that we've had in the past, right, where it was an advocacy body. There were two houses gathered to pass resolutions and to liaise with the government and make recommendations to the government and talk to the government, and even had prime ministers like Richard Seddon go along and observe. And it wasn't a threat because it wasn't something that was intended to supplant the law of the land, right? And so, and that's the only point I was trying to make.
But here's an interesting point, though. That's fine. I agree with you. I want to do the same thing with my family, with my children, my grandchildren, all of those sorts of things. I want to pass on that my own Christian faith in that regard. But I don't expect anybody to pay for that other than myself.
No, that's true.
Right? And this is where, you know, we have the grandstanding of Te Pāti Māori, Rāwiri Waititi, saying that he's declaring independence from Parliament. Well, he hasn't resigned from Parliament, so he's not independent of Parliament because he's still getting his salary.
Yeah.
It's grandstanding, but the expectation that they'll say that, well, Article 3 of the treaty says that you'll pay for it, Whitey.
Yeah. Well, I don't know what that's not independence for one thing. You're quite right. And you know, the Kotahi, I think it was called the Kotahi Hatanga, which was the Māori parliament in the 19th century. That wasn't a state-supported thing. You did have people who were members of both. That's because it wasn't seen as being inconsistent. And, you know, if TPM or its, outspoken leadership was to say that that's wanting to supplant the New Zealand parliament or replace it, then I would completely agree with you, and that would be a completely hypocritical act on their part.
Establish a parallel system of government where our existing parliament has to consult with and get approval from the Maori parliament. Because I see that as an interim step that they would want to push, you know, part of the partnership, as part of, this lie that they never ceded sovereignty. I interviewed Catherine Ennis Carter last week, and she said, you know, in the 70s and early 80s, the predominant argument from Maori about the treaty was that they was duped, that it was a fraud, that they were tricked, and as a result, impoverished because of that. And of course, that's now morphed in the 90s and the 2000s and where we are now, 24 years since the year 2000, into we never ceded sovereignty, you owe us everything, and Article 3 says that you'll pay for it. That's where we've got to from a document that is a historic fact and is written there in plain language for anyone who cares to know. There's this morphing of the meaning of words to say things that were never said or agreed to.
So my take on all that is a little bit contrarian too. I mean, I've always said, like, you know, I think, you know, we can argue as a matter of history, like, about what the treaty was designed for and how it was received, what was intended by the meaning of it. But it doesn't change the subsequent history, right? And so sovereignty doesn't come from a treaty. Sovereignty comes from legitimate government, right? Like we don't go
the
back
formation of a parliament and acts of parliament and acceptance by the majority of the population.
100% right, right? And so we don't go back and try and undo the Norman conquest on the basis that, you know,
or the Danegeld area of Britain, you know, when the Vikings conquered 2/3 of the UK.
So the Norman conquest was, you know, William the Conqueror said, look, I've got a claim to the throne of England. You know, it was a dubious claim, but, you know.
It was a claim.
But it wasn't the claim that established his sovereignty. His sovereignty was he actually exercised it, right? And he became the king. And over time, that evolved into what we now call the United Kingdom.
Yep.
And it's the same here, right? Like, you know, whatever the history was, the reality is that we have a sovereign crown. The crown is, you know, has a democratic element to it. So it's got democratic legitimacy. It's the only.
It's a constitutional monarchy.
It's a constitutional monarchy. It checks the box in terms of being a efficient, fair, reasonable, and accountable government. You know, to an extent.
And we know how Maori see that because they started to set up their own Kingitanga movement, and did set up their own Kingitanga movement because they thought it was a good idea.
And their own parliament, right, too, right, in attempts to that. Now, the point that I would just make is that, you know, like, it's a interesting and worthy historical inquiry, but it doesn't change the fact that the Crown has got sovereignty. The Crown can't give up that sovereignty because the Crown is democratically accountable to everybody. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, to me, it wouldn't bother me in the slightest, right, if we had a second chamber of parliament and you said, right, okay, well, look, in fairness, you know, there was clearly some sort of idea that the Rangatira would continue to have some sort of status or authority or some sort of voice distinctive as the basis of being the people who are already here and the people who signed the treaty. And as long as this upper house was a House of Lords type upper house where it, you know, it was a revising chamber only, it could make suggestions only, kind of like a select committee, and control remained with the democratic elements, it wouldn't bother me in the slightest if you were to have an upper house and you were to say, like the House of Lords, that you know, there is a space for the for at least some seats to be allocated to the landed gentry or the nobility, in this case, you know, to iwi, right? And that wouldn't bother me in the slightest, just as it wouldn't bother me to be in England in the House of Lords and have, you know, some hereditary peers.
Well, other than the fact it goes against the Kiwi ethos of Jack's as good as his master. You know, there's a reason why we don't have an upper house, right?
Yep, I know. Right. But I'm just trying to square different things here. And all I'm saying is it wouldn't bother me as long as the control remained with the House of Representatives, like in the UK, right? The House of Lords can be a real pain in the neck, frequently is, for the House of Commons. But there's no doubt that the House of Commons is in charge because the House of Commons is the only body that represents everyone. Same goes for the House of Representatives in New Zealand. That's where its legitimacy comes from. It doesn't come from a piece of paper.
Nor does it come from a improperly stated Declaration of Independence.
No, that's right. And that's the thing. So with the terms of what I was, you know, TVM want to have their own parliament, fine. You know, they can't establish a state in New Zealand. They don't have even the electoral support to really say that they represent Māori. So, you know, good luck, guys. You know, it's on you. We have freedom of assembly. We have freedom of speech. We have freedom of all sorts in this country. If you can, you know, establish that you've got some sort of legitimacy to speak for all Māori, then go for it. But, you know, I just have to say that your work's cut out for you based on the low level of support that you have amongst the population at large.
It's 3.08%, if you want to be particular about that.
Yeah.
3.8%. They 87,844 votes. And, you know, it's interesting because I looked at the results for the Manurewa electorate because it's pertinent at the moment with these allegations of, well, impropriety and all sorts of other things. The actual votes that were cast in that electorate were, well, let's just say scant.
Well, that's the thing about those electorates is why they're so unpredictable, right, is that they're set on basis of population, by the turnout so low that you know, you can have these wild results. Remember Titai Tokerau and how easy that one was to influence? You know, like, remember was there a by-election or wasn't there? Did Kelvin win that in a by-election or what happened? I can't quite remember. You were involved. You did a Operation Chaos type thing, didn't you?
So they say. I can't really remember.
I'm not accusing you of anything, but I remember it was there was a movement to sort of to support Kelvin Davis against Honey Harira, I think.
Yeah, from something memory. Like that. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, the total votes cast in Tamaki Makaurau electorate, 25,000 votes were cast. 25,604. Pene Henare got 10,026 and Takatai Tash Kemp got 10,068, a margin of just 42.
Yeah.
But those are small numbers.
Yeah, I know. And that's why they're so unpredictable, right? That's you can easily influence them. Now, a really interesting thing is, if you're talking about inconsistencies, do you remember all the times that people were saying about X, sort of distorting Parliament?
I just laughed it off.
But nobody ever talks about the issue, the democratic issues with the overhang, with the strategic voting and the Māori electorates.
I don't think anybody's mentioned the overhang that was created by the Māori Party getting 3% of the votes and getting, you know, seven seats. You know?
Yeah,
but nobody said it. Not even mentioned, is it?
No. And so, you know, you can imagine if ACT and had a similar sort of thing where they won more electorates consistently than party vote entitlements, there would be calls to reform MMP almost daily. But
you see similar complaints too about, they talk about the big money in elections and ACT has got the big money. And I always just laugh at people who make those claims, because if money bought elections, ACT would be the majority party. They just absolute fortune, right? But they don't get the results. That's because their ideas aren't accepted by the majority of New Zealanders.
Yeah, it's proof that you can't buy elections. It's just correct. It is. And in fact, the more that you put out your propaganda, the more widespread it is, the more damage you might even do to yourself if people don't agree with it. Right.
Well, yeah, exactly. And Colin Craig's the other example. He spent you know, something like $5 million and didn't get into Parliament. Thank God, you know, I might have had a hand in that, but
Gareth Morgan.
Others. So there's three data points that show that money doesn't actually influence elections. It's ideas that influence elections.
Right. The other thing I'd say to that, and this is why I think that sort of battles over the National Party, are important, is that, you know, both the National Party and the Labour Party, like they have a couple hundred years of history. And that means they've got networks and machinery and ins and institutional knowledge that the other parties just don't have. And I actually think that matters a lot more than people in the media sort of are willing to recognise. It's the your ordinary Joes who are, you know, your volunteer networks, people who are going out and dropping leaflets. And that gets you more support than money can. And that's why it was always annoying to me when people would say, oh, we'd like to have a sort of a social conservative party that would just be outside of the National Party providing support to it, and the National Party can continue to be the sort of urban liberal party, you know, the senior partner. And I was like, well, no, you leave, because actually it's not just, you know, the brand or whatever. It's also all of that machinery underneath, all of those networks.
Well, we saw that at the last election too with, you know, Liz Gunn and her New Zealand Loyal Party, if you could call it a party, dictatorship's probably a better word, but this is the problem. I get people all the time, they say to me, Cam, I'd like to, you know, engage you to look at the setting up of a new political party, and I almost invariably turn it down because they can never answer two basic questions. What is your plan to get 5% of the vote? And the second question is, what's your plan to win an electorate seat?
Yeah.
And they usually sit there and go, there's a lot of angry people.
Yeah.
Well, there was a lot of angry people at the last election, and it didn't work. Mm-hmm. Right? So that doesn't translate into votes. Likes on Facebook don't translate into votes.
Yeah.
You know, retweets don't translate into votes.
It's like everything, right? Like, it looks easy from the outside, and you know, people can, they read the news and they'll read blogs and they'll think, oh, I could do this. But actually, as people who have been around politics, you know, you and I both know that actually it's a lot of hard work and organization that goes uncredited. And that's why I think political parties like the National Party, to be honest, need to be a bit better to their volunteers and a bit more, you know, cultivating and respectful of their volunteers, because actually, you know, it's, man. It's
I can easy. Remember when they
Don't
launched
treat them
a membership.
Like employees.
Yeah, yeah, I can remember when they launched a membership card. I was a member back then. That's I haven't been a member for 15 years of the National Party, but that's when they launched a membership card. And I got this piece of plastic and I thought, well, what do I get for this?
Yeah.
Right, I've donated some money. What do I get for being a member of the National Party? Well, what you got was a plastic card.
Yeah.
That was it. You don't get any thanks. You don't get anything else. There's no special privileges for it. And, in fact, the only thing I could come up that plastic card was useful for was scraping the ice off the windscreen on the 2 days of the year in Auckland where you get a frost.
Some of them, some MPs, in fairness, are good at it. And you think, some Ian Brown's someone that I think is an example of
Judith
someone who's
Collins is another one.
Yep. They're both, Judith Collins is a great example.
They look after their electorate. They've got a very strong electorate organization. Yep. Their volunteers are appreciated.
Yeah.
And that's why they've got very, very high memberships, because
even when they go out of their electorate and come and visit the provinces. Yeah. They mingle amongst members. They treat members with respect, and you know, that leads to a lot. You know, that leads to a lot of staying power, right? And it just does. And you know, on the other hand, if you have people who are you know, parachuted into, that's what I always really hate a little bit. Sort of people who come back from overseas. They've had made a lot of money overseas, and they come back and they're like
John Key, Christopher Luxon.
look, I'm not. Don't draw me into anything like that. Oh, please.
I'll go there. I'm happy to go there.
No,
it was my father that recruited John Key into the National Party.
Well, let's go with David Kirk. Okay.
All right.
Well,
yeah.
You know, okay. So, you know, people.
Well, I was involved in that too.
Yes, I know. That's why I brought it up. So, you know, people who are, you know, they always think that you should be grateful to them for them putting their hand up to stand. And I just think that, you know, like we should deter as many of those people as possible, right? Like you should need to put your time in at getting to know members, being a true party member, instead of like being someone who is
parachuted in.
Yeah, a lateral hire, you know, like you're a lateral, you know, we should be fewer lateral hires.
Well, that was a spectacular failure with David Kirk. I mean, they picked the wrong electorate to parachute him into.
Yeah.
I mean, Clem Simich was an earnest sort of a fellow, but not particularly bright, but he was a local.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? And
the Tamaki Mafia worked really hard on that. And that's what they were known inside the National Party.
And I love that story for that reason.
You know? Yeah. It's like you can't just, sometimes it doesn't work. You just get, you just get smashed. Well, we're coming up against time, Liam, but I think we've traversed quite a few topics there.
Yeah. No, I enjoyed it. It was good talk.
Yeah. So thanks so much for coming on the Crunch, and we'll have you back again soon.
It was my pleasure.
Liam's article about Chloe Swarbrick was satire, but nonetheless it was on point. And it seems it's a political construction of her own talking points that the facts show to be nothing short of intellectual dishonesty on her part. Naturally, the media go along with it. I'm in two minds about his views on Te Pāti Māori and a Māori parliament, though. What do you think? Email inbox at realitycheck.radio or text to 2057.
Thank you for tuning in to RCR, Reality Check Radio. If you like what you're listening to or dislike what you're listening to, either way, we want to hear from you. Get in touch with us now. You can text us with your message to 2057, that's 2057, or email us at inbox@realitycheck.radio. We would love to hear from you, so connect with us today.